From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. King, would you stand up, please, sir? Based on these answers, I hereby sentence you to death by lethal injection. Sheriff, you may take him to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to await an execution date.
White supremacist Bill King went to death row yesterday for chaining a black man to a pickup truck and dragging him to his death. We'll also talk to Congressmember Jesse Jackson Jr. about a new Hope for Africa Act and Millions for Mumia. People mobilize around the country for a major demonstration on April 24th. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Smirking and cursing his victim's family as he was led away, white supremacist John William King went to death row yesterday for chaining a black man to a pickup truck and dragging him to pieces. 11 white jurors and their elected black foreman took less than 3 hours to sentence King to lethal injection rather than life in prison, taking about the same amount of time they needed to convict him Tuesday of murdering James Byrd Jr., one of the grisliest racial crimes since the civil rights era. King becomes the first white sent to death row in Texas for killing a black person since capital punishment resumed in the 1970s. Texas has executed only one white person for killing a black person in 1854. Byrd's relatives wiped their eyes after hearing the death sentence but declined Judge Joe Bob Golden's offer to say something to King. Byrd's nephew, Darrell Verrett, held up his fingers in a V sign and said everything's okay. On the courthouse lawn, women high-fived each other and exclaimed, "Justice is served." This news in San Francisco, President Clinton will be pushing his foreign policy goals as he speaks to business and policy leaders in San Francisco today. Aides say Clinton will use the speech to detail his vision for, quote, supporting peace, prosperity, and freedom into the next century. He's expected to discuss peace in the Middle East, expanding trade, and the situations in Kosovo and Northern Ireland, among other things. After today's San Francisco appearance, Clinton will go to Los Angeles for a fundraiser. Tomorrow, he heads to Utah for a ski vacation with his wife and daughter. There's always a few. That's what the president's spokesman says about the small but loud groups of demonstrators who've been dogging Clinton's visit to the West. In Tucson yesterday, about 200 demonstrators chanted, "Jail to the chief." And as he arrived in San Francisco last night, Clinton's motorcade passed by several dozen protesters chanting, "Shame." Earlier, the exclusive Pacific Heights district where Clinton spoke to a big money fundraiser had been posted with flyers that were headlined, "Neighborhood Alert," and warned that a sexual predator was on the way. Clinton spokesman Joe Lockhart told reporters San Francisco is well known for creative free speech. These protests were about the recently broadcast on NBC interview with Juanita Broderick, who says that President Clinton raped her 21 years ago. She was a nursing home operator in Arkansas. She said that he came to her hotel room and, against her wishes, he raped her. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright will meet East Timorese rebel leader Xanana Gusmão on March 5th, this according to Gusmão's lawyers. Albright will be the most senior foreign representative ever to meet Gusmão, who was moved earlier this month to house arrest in Jakarta from prison. In 1993, he was sentenced to 20 years in jail for his armed fight against Indonesia's rule of East Timor. Also, resistance leaders in the jungles of East Timor have claimed victory over Indonesia's armed forces and promised complete freedom for the troubled country. And this news from France, a ship carrying reprocessed nuclear waste from France to Japan will sail through the Panama Canal on a journey described by anti-nuclear activists as fraught with risks. France's nuclear reprocessing company, Kojima, disclosed the ship's route today, 24 hours after the vessel, described by the environmental group Greenpeace as a sailing Chernobyl, left the French Channel port of Cherbourg. From Richmond, Virginia, lawmakers in Virginia, home to America Online, the nation's largest internet service provider, adopted legislation that would make it a crime to send mass unsolicited electronic mailings or spam on the internet. The bill, which Virginia Governor James Gilmore has promised to sign, would make Virginia the first state in the nation to have the power to criminally prosecute people accused of spamming. The measure would have far-reaching implications because about half the nation's internet infrastructure is routed through the state. And the family of the late Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos has agreed to pay $150 million in damages to 10,000 victims of human rights abuses after a 13-year legal battle. This according to the victims' lawyers. Under the preliminary agreement, the distribution of the money would be supervised by the U.S. District Court in Hawaii, which in 1993 found Marcos liable for atrocities committed by soldiers during his rule. A despot who abuses his people will finally pay. This in a statement said by U.S.-based lawyer Robert Swift and Filipino lawyer Rod Domingo, the victim's counsel. Domingo, who released the statement in Manila, told Reuters the agreement would still need the approval of the Manila government, which has accused Marcos of looting the treasury and also claims his assets.
Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my head was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help the same? Songs of freedom.
Freedom
is all I ever had.
All I ever had.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and once again, good day to all of our listeners across the country.
Well, we are going to go down to Jasper, as we have every day now, for a few weeks, because the trial, including the sentencing of Bill King, has ended. The family of the Jasper, Texas man dragged to death by white supremacists hopes the nation can learn a lesson from yesterday's death sentence. Relatives of James Byrd Jr. say the professional investigation and prosecution of the case show that society has no tolerance for hate crimes. And the ailing father of convicted killer Bill King is also calling for reconciliation. In a statement issued after his son was sentenced to die, Ronald King said, quote, "We must learn to love one another and not hate." Bill King is the first white person condemned for killing a black in Texas since the 1970s. King spent his first night as a condemned man at the James Byrd Diagnostic Unit in Huntsville. The facility is named after a deceased warden unrelated to King's victim. King is to be transferred today to death row. We're joined right now by Jeremy Scahill, Pacifica reporter who has been covering the trial. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy, and good morning to both you and Juan.
Well, why don't you start just by telling us what happened yesterday?
Well, yesterday, Bill King's attorney, Brack Jones, one of his attorneys, when he was arguing to the jury to try to save Bill King's life, he said to them that whether you vote life or death, William King is a dead man walking. And yesterday, the Jasper jury of 11 whites and one African-American made convicted killer Bill King a condemned man on his way to death row. The only African-American on the jury who was served as the jury's foreman handed the decision to Judge Joe Bob Golden, and then Judge Joe Bob Golden read it to the court.
Mr. King, would you stand up, please, sir? Based on these answers, I hereby sentence you to death by lethal injection. Sheriff, you may take him to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to await an execution date.
You know, it's interesting, Amy. When Judge Joe Bob Golden read that, there was hardly any reaction at all from Bill King, and as we've talked about before, he just sat stoically through the whole trial, mostly with his left hand just covering up his mouth, and he didn't show any reaction at all until he went outside. And when they brought him out of the court after he was sentenced to death, he came out smirking, and reporters started shouting questions at him, and one reporter said to him, you know, do you have any message for the family of James Byrd Jr.? Do you have any message for the Byrd family? And he smirked, and he said an obscenity, and what that obscenity was is he said that they should suck his blank. It just shows a man with absolutely no remorse. I think it really disgusted even their family spokesperson, Catholic priest Father Ron Fossage. I think that, you know, he just clearly has shown that he has no remorse for what he did. And then he issued a statement which quotes a Nazi sympathizer who was present at the Nuremberg trials. And that statement from John William King says, "Though I remain adamant about my innocence, it's been obvious from the beginning that this community would get what they desire. So I'll close with the words of Francis Yoki. The promise of success is with the man who is determined to die proudly when it is no longer possible to live proudly. And this is actually interesting because he, in one of his letters that was intercepted at the jail shortly after he was arrested, he was sending messages back and forth between him and his co-defendant, Lawrence Russell Brewer. And in one of those, he said that even if we get the death penalty, we've made history, and we know we'll die proudly remembered.
Well, Jeremy, one of the things that has happened in other parts of the country, for instance, civil rights leaders have called the conviction of King a sad victory and urged Congress to pass tough anti-hate legislation. Kwasi Nfumi, the president of the NAACP, said this guilty verdict in the James Byrd murder trial is a sad victory, and this the first step of a troubling judicial ordeal. And, of course, we had Reverend Jesse Jackson condemning the jury's decision on the death penalty and saying that the state of Texas lacked, quote, the moral authority to kill anyone. What's been the reaction, again, there of the civil rights leaders to this latest turn?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we've talked before about the reaction of the NAACP, and in general, civil rights leaders here have not been quick to criticize that jury for handing down the death sentence. Even one of James Byrd Jr.'s sisters, Clara Taylor, who has been speaking very forcefully in favor of Bill King getting the death penalty, said yesterday at a press conference that the family were not advocates of the death penalty, but that they felt that there was no way for justice to be done because Bill King, there was not an option of giving him a life sentence without the possibility of parole, and they were fearing that he was going to get out in 40 years. And another point that prosecutors were raising is that they didn't want Bill King to have any opportunity to be around a black doctor or a black nurse or a black psychologist or a Jewish guard. You know, they didn't want him to have any contact with anyone. And, you know, even Guy James Gray said he's not big on the death penalty. And we talked about that yesterday in Democracy Now! I think, Juan, in a nutshell, people here are not quick to condemn that jury. And I think a lot of people, even people who are opposed to the death penalty, feel that there was really no other solution or other choice to it.
Jeremy, let's hear what one of James Byrd's relatives had to say after yesterday's sentencing of Bill King to the death penalty.
It's a relief to us to finally have one of these perpetrators brought to justice and receive a just sentence.
That was Clara Taylor, the sister of James Byrd Jr., who has been really the sort of spokesperson for the family. She and also Renee Mullins, the 28-year-old daughter of James Byrd Jr. As for white supremacist Bill King, his family, his father wasn't in court yesterday when the sentence was handed down. He had gotten very ill earlier in the day. He himself is bound to a wheelchair and is on an oxygen mask, and so he was not present for that decision. And it's interesting to go back to Juan, your point about what are civil rights leaders saying here. Even the Jasper County District Attorney, Guy James Gray, he said he wished he didn't have to ask the jury for a death sentence, but felt he had no choice, and we can hear that right now.
To be as honest as I know how, if there was some way that you could lock this man up forever and he would never get out of jail and he wouldn't have the opportunity to hurt anybody, life sentence should be a consideration in any case. I'm not big on the death penalty, but in this particular case, that's just not possible. I don't want this man out when he's 64, 65 years old. I don't want him around nurses. I don't want him around doctors. He's got too many opportunities to hurt somebody, and it wouldn't mean anything to him if he were locked up for life. If he hurt somebody else, it wouldn't add to his time. It wouldn't change his circumstances.
Jasper County District Attorney Guy James Gray. One of the other lawyers for Bill King, C. Hayden Sonny Cribbs, is a very well-known East Texas defense lawyer. He's a very staunch opponent of the death penalty, and he said that the heinous nature of this crime didn't change his conviction at all. He said he's always been against the death penalty. He remains opposed to the death penalty, and he really, you could see in the courtroom when he was making the final appeal on behalf of Bill King, someone who he very clearly doesn't respect the views of, but has grown to like because he's around him so much, and he really wanted to save his life. And he was in a difficult position. He was getting hammered away by the press every day on how can you represent this guy. But he was saying everyone in this country deserves a right to representation and that the system in this country shouldn't be judged on the people that we love the most, but on those that we despise. And in his closing remarks to the jury before they went off to deliberate, He said, you know, some people believe in an eye for an eye, and that comes from the Old Testament. And then there's the New Testament, and there's different teachings there. He said, but I want to go back to the first book of the Bible, Genesis, to the first recorded murder, which was when Cain killed Abel by beating him with a rock. He said, God banished him with a mark on his head. He didn't kill him. And he said, I'm going to ask you to banish him to suffer for the rest of his life. I'm begging you to not kill this boy.
My religion and my faith and my belief in Jesus Christ teaches me that God can forgive any sin, but the condition is that we have to be sorry. And I think what troubles me so much right now is I don't think Bill is sorry, although I can't read into his heart. But I'm praying, and I've asked our people to pray, that somebody will touch Bill if he gets the death penalty before he dies, so that he becomes sorry. Because, you know, without judging him, I think if he died today, he'd go to hell.
That was Father Ron Frosage, who was the King family spokesperson. And he, you know, to be honest, he didn't know Bill King before any of this. He did know the father of Bill King, Ronald King, and has sort of become the spokesperson for the family and has been the main supporter of Ronald King and has read his statements when he has released them to the press. I think now we're going to go and hear from Sonny Cribbs, the lawyer for Bill King. He, a very dejected Sonny Cribbs, came out and talked to reporters after the sentence was handed down.
I knew what the evidence was going to be under the rules of discovery. We started off probably with the idea that the best we might can do is, like Brock said yesterday, maybe defeat the kidnapping. Other than that, it would hard be imagined a situation where you'd have a 10-2 verdict on that. So the best we're probably hoping for was to get some juror that at least would hang on one of the issues, which results in a death penalty, but you can't tell them that. I mean, a non-death penalty, but you can't advise the jury that. They've got to be advised of the law. So you've got to start with an idea of maybe you can get one juror who's somewhat has some sympathy for your cause. You take the facts of this, that's awfully, awfully difficult.
And that, of course, was C. Hayden Sonny Cribbs, the lawyer for white supremacist Bill King. Amy?
Well, Jeremy, this has really wrapped up your time in Jasper, Texas, as we come to the end of the trial of Bill King. Now, he's just one of three people who are going to be tried for capital murder of James Byrd. What are we going to see in the next few months? When are they tried? Who are they?
Well, their names are Sean Berry and Lawrence Russell Brewer. Lawrence Russell Brewer is an old prison buddy of Bill King, and he came to Jasper and was just sort of hanging out with Bill King for weeks prior to the murder. Sean Berry is a Jasper boy himself, and so he's the only one who really is from Jasper, born and raised, but not Bill King or Lawrence Russell Brewer. Those two, though, they're going to have a difficulty finding a jury pool in Jasper, and so their trials may take place elsewhere in neighboring counties or even over in Galveston. But I think one fitting way to end all of this coverage is to just remind people what exactly happened last summer. And we'll never know, probably, the entire truth of what happened, but the sheer brutality of it should remain always with us. And I forever will have the autopsy photos of James Byrd Jr. Fossilized in my head, seeing his corpse burnt by the friction on the road that early morning of June 7th, when these three white men, Bill King and his two alleged conspirators, took James Byrd Jr. in the back of their truck, drove him out to a rural African-American area of Jasper, beat him, chained him by his ankles to a 24-and-a-half-foot logging chain, dragged him for 2 miles on the pavement through a rural African-American community as he shifted back and forth, trying to alleviate the suffering from each part of his body as limbs were coming off, as fingers were coming off. And eventually they drove so fast into a culvert that it tore the upper right half of his body off. It tore his right arm, his shoulder, part of his neck, and his head off. And they left that in front of a black church and cemetery. And then they continued to drive down that road with his torso, leaving it in front of the cemetery as well. The brutality of this should never, ever go from any of our hearts or our minds. And I agree with all of the civil rights workers around the country who are saying that we need to remember this when we talk about hate crimes, that this is a sad victory that Bill King was convicted. It's sad, you know, that he is going to death row, but the brutality of the crime should always remain with us.
Jeremy Scahill, reporting from Jasper, Texas. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop Jatai. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Well, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill Jabo.
Help me sing
these songs of freedom.
Freedom
is all I ever had.
All I ever had.
Redemption song. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop Jah Tide. How long shall they kill our prophets? Why do we stand aside and look? Well, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill Jabo. Won't you help us sing these songs of freedom?
All I ever had,
redemption song. I say, all I ever had, all I ever had, redemption song.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Just a minute, we're going to talk about Africa and a new bill that's been introduced on Africa. We'll be talking to Jesse Jackson Jr. But I wanted to just bring you this news. A Guatemalan Truth Commission yesterday blasted the army for most of the atrocities committed during the last four decades and accused the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency of sponsoring human rights violations. Christian Tomachat, head of the Historical Clarification Commission, blamed the army for 93% of massacres, tortures, disappearances, and assassinations during Guatemala's last 40 years, in which an estimated 200,000 people, mostly Mayan peasants, were killed. Moving from Guatemala now to Africa and to U.S. policy in Africa, Juan.
Well, Amy, this week, Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. of Illinois announced his Hope for Africa Act, an alternative bill to the Growth and Opportunity Act, the Africa trade bill sponsored by senior Ways and Means Republican Representative Phil Crane that was passed by the House last year by a 233-186 vote. Crane's bill envisions quota-free and duty-free exports from 48 African countries and includes plans to establish a U.S.-Africa free trade zone. Opponents of Crane's bill have said that it is also a license for U.S. multinationals to exploit Africa's poor. Jackson's Hope for Africa Act seeks forgiveness for more than $200 billion in debt to the U.S. private banks and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So I want to welcome Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. And it's been a while since we've talked. I think several years ago we went with your father and Dennis Rivera on a trip to Cuba that I was covering that you were on. But I'd like to ask you a little bit about how your bill differs from the one that Congress has already passed and why you felt it was necessary to present it at this time.
Well, let me first begin by saying good morning, Juan, and good morning, Amy.
Hi.
It's indeed an honor and a privilege to have the opportunity to be on your show. Juan, to overcome a nearly 400-year legacy of unregulated business, investment, and trade that gave us slavery, it gave us colonialism and widespread human and economic exploitation, I introduced H.R. 772, the Hope for Africa Act of 1999, based on human rights, that's hope, the H in hope, opportunity, partnership, and empowerment as the basis of a new respectful and mutually beneficial human and economic relationship. What unregulated business, the Crane bill and investment has given sub-Saharan Africa, including structural adjustments, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, it has given them unserviceable debt, And our government uses that debt to leverage the poorest economies in the world into creating more favorable terms for very large multinationals to come in and take advantage of natural resources and cheap labor. And so our bill, Human Rights Opportunity Partnership and Empowerment, is a trade act. We have many of the provisions of the Crane bill in our bill, except we operate on a completely different premise, that the benefits of trade going into the future, unlike NAFTA and unlike previous trade agreements, must be shared widely by the majority of common and working people in every participating society, not just benefit the business and the financial interests of an elite few. And we accomplish that by making sure that every sub-Saharan African worker, more than 750 million of them, will be paid a minimum wage, that their environment will be protected. And the benefits of our bill do not accrue to those corporations that would take advantage of the bill unless they comply with labor standards that that we're very familiar with in our own country.
Now, some of the publicity around your introducing this bill has focused on the fact that, for instance, other more senior African American members of Congress, like Charlie Rangel, are still very much supportive of the original measure that was passed. And what kind of discussions have occurred, for instance, within the Black Caucus over this bill, and how are people lining up within the caucus in terms of having an open debate and taking stands on it?
Well, a lot of African Americans in the Congressional Black Caucus who voted for the Crane-Rangel bill in the last Congress are now original co-sponsors of our bill and have taken their name off of the Crane-Rangel bill for a whole host of reasons. Number one, in the last Congress, there was no alternative to the Republican approach, the Crane approach, to how to do business with Africa. The other important thing is we have to tie debt relief to the business and investment component, or the Republicans will never come back and take care of what sub-Saharan Africa fundamentally needs, and that is to be able to invest in their own local economies, in their own health care, in their own infrastructure, which up to 20%, for example, in Mozambique, of their export earnings go to pay debt in the first world. And so many African Americans in the Congress, Cynthia McKinney and Elijah Cummings and Maxine Waters, who supported the H.R. 434 in the last bill, are now saying that Jesse's bill is a better bill for sub-Saharan Africa, and it makes sense. I might also add, Juan and Amy, that only our bill forces U.S. corporations and the multinational corporations to be in business with sub-Saharan Africans. Jesse Jr., what do you mean? Well, it's real simple. Our bill says that 60% of all corporations who benefit under the bill must hire and be in partnership with sub-Saharan Africans. An Afrikaner newspaper wrote an editorial the other day that said, Jesse Jr. has the nerve to say that we must do business with Africans. That's the difference between our two bills. My bill enforces and ensures that some wealth will remain in sub-Saharan Africa, that African people might be able to develop and not just export all of that wealth out of the country and put it in the hands of a few, which is one of the reasons why civil wars and undemocratic regimes have been historically propped up in the subcontinent.
We're talking to Illinois Congressmember Jesse Jackson Jr. about the bill that he's just introduced this week, H.R. 772, called Hope for Africa. And this is in contrast to a bill that, is that right, has already been passed, the Africa trade bill that President Clinton pushed so hard on passing before he made his trip to Africa. So I wanted to ask you, Congressman Jackson, in the Washington Post, it describes your bill as evading the labor trap of, they call it the Rangel legislation, I guess we could say the Rangel-Crane legislation, because Africa's textile exports would come out of the quota assigned to China, so there would be no net volume gain or corresponding U.S. job loss. Can you explain that?
Sure, I can. In Kenya and Mauritius, for example, we treat quotas, export quotas, the exact same way that the Crane bill, except the benefits under our bill only accrue if, in fact, one, 80% and now 90%, we're saying in our bill, of all workers in sub-Saharan Africa are hired by U.S. corporations as opposed to bringing workers in from China to do the labor. They must hire sub-Saharan Africans, and 60% of those corporations must be owned by sub-Saharan Africans. The net effect of that ownership provision ensures that there will be a minimum wage in sub-Saharan Africa. And as many people know, many of these quotas for textiles and apparels under the GATT rules will be phased out between 2002 and 2005. We simply transfer the existing quota in China, which overwhelmingly, by the way, will be the biggest player in the textile and apparel market once the quotas are phased out, to sub-Saharan Africa, and therefore there is no net gain or loss in U.S. jobs. It essentially remains the same. The international quota that allows textile and apparels to come into the United States will have no corresponding loss on imports or exports from the United States to other countries, and therefore preserving the job base. The American textile manufacturers have found this to be a very, very acceptable provision, which ensures that the 1.4 million Americans who work in the textile industry will not lose their jobs. Now, some have even argued, Amy, if I can say this very quickly, some have even argued that our textile provisions should be given to, should be taken and put in the Rangel-Crane bill. Would that be more acceptable? The answer to that question is no, because the ownership provisions must also, African, sub-Saharan African ownership must also be put there. Debt relief must also be put there. And the reestablishment of a line item appropriation to help sub-Saharan Africa redevelop its schools and its infrastructure must also be put there, and they can't just tear the bill apart and take sections of it.
I just want to let our listeners know that we did attempt to get Congressmembers Crane, also Republican Congressman Manzullo, as well as Congressman Rangel on the show. With Congressman Rangel, it just might be a matter of his aides not being able to get to him. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get any of them on the show who are big supporters of the bill that passed.
Well, Congressman Jackson, another provision of the bill, as I understand, would direct a certain minimum level of U.S. foreign aid to sub-Saharan Africa, and also direct that portions of it be used for AIDS research and control of environmental problems. Could you, in sub-Saharan Africa, could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Africa is the only continent that the United States of America does not give any foreign aid to. We give approximately $3 billion a year to Israel, approximately $1 billion a year to Egypt because of the Middle East crisis and the arrangements that we've worked out with those countries. But as a continent, sub-Saharan Africa receives not $1 from the United States government. Newt Gingrich in 1994 removed that appropriation from the bill. I reestablished an $802 million appropriation, the 94-level appropriation, to sub-Saharan Africa that they might be able to rebuild their schools. Even President Rawlins, who's in the United States now, said most recently that, yes, we support business and investment and trade, but we need debt relief because whatever investments you make in our countries, if, in fact, we cannot rebuild our infrastructure and secure your investments with democratic regimes in our country, your investments will go by the wayside because they'll probably end up in civil wars over food and economic security. And so we want to make sure that the vast majority of people benefit under a trade bill, which is what our bill certainly accomplishes. Let me also add that only our bill has such an appropriation. Of the 750 million sub-Saharan Africans, 20 million of them presently have HIV or AIDS. 83% of all AIDS-related deaths since 1983 have occurred in sub-Saharan Africa. Only that appropriation goes towards AIDS education, goes towards preventative measures for AIDS, and also our money, the money that we give to non-government organizations, can also be used to look for landmines. President Rawlins said just the other day that we have thousands of acres that could be farmed so that we could feed millions of our people, except that no one wants to farm the land because the civil wars and the Cold War have left landmines, which Princess Diana was very concerned about, all over Angola, all over Mozambique, and all over Ghana. And so only a line item appropriation to non-government organizations even gives those countries an opportunity to begin to look for landmines that they might be able to feed their people, which ultimately will secure foreign and domestic investment in sub-Saharan Africa.
Rawlings is the president of Ghana. In fact, that issue of aid is how Congressman Rangel from New York dismisses your bill, calling it an aid bill, not a trade bill, and saying that the quota reallocation on the issue that we were talking about of trade is nothing but a political statement to placate labor unions.
Well, that's not, it's actually not true, and it's unfortunate that the congressman has sought to dismiss our bill as an aid bill. Our bill is a comprehensive development plan. President Rawlings also said when he was here to President Clinton that I don't want you to do for us what you don't do for Europe. Don't do for us what you don't do for other parts of the world. And the audience that he was speaking to just burst out in laughter and started clapping. And once they stopped clapping, President Rawlings then turned to President Clinton and said, now I think you ought to clap too. I saw everyone in here clapping except for you. Don't treat me any differently than you treat other people anywhere in the world. When President Hussein, King Hussein, died in Jordan, the first thing we did was we forgave their debt, about $300 million. And we also sent them and promised them $300 million a year for the next 3 years so that the new king, King Abdullah, would have a stable reign during the initial part of his reign so that no one would overturn or seek to destabilize the region by overturning his government. All President Rawlings and all sub-Saharan African nations are asking us to do is to do business with us like you do business with everybody else. There has been, Amy, no shortage of business and investment and trade with sub-Saharan Africa. 30 million African Americans are in America today because of a 400-year trade policy with sub-Saharan Africa. Many of us have been doing business, Chevron, Gulf, Exxon. They have been in sub-Saharan Africa for years. Nigeria's in OPEC, one of the nation's world's leading export petroleum companies, because we've been trading with Africa for years. The problem is that many of the beneficiaries of trade have only been entrenched presidents who are elected for life or military dictators, and the vast majority of 750 million people have never been able to buy their own home or purchase their own equipment or buy their own farms. So we have to ensure that whatever natural resources are extracted out of the ground, that the vast majority of people benefit from that.
Well, Congressman Jackson, when you talk about debt relief, I don't know if many of our listeners and stations around the country fully understand the importance of this issue. For instance, I know throughout Latin America, many countries in Latin America, especially in Central America and the poorer countries in the Caribbean, must end up every year having to direct as much as a third to a half of their total revenues just to pay debt service to international banks and the World Bank and the IMF. How drastic is this issue in sub-Saharan Africa? Is it comparable? Is it an even worse situation for many of these countries?
Let me try. We have about 30 seconds.
Well, let me try and break it down for you as quickly as I can then. When my wife and I bought a house the other day, the first thing the banks told us we had to do was pay off all of our credit cards because we couldn't afford the house unless our credit cards were paid off. Well, sub-Saharan African per capita income, those families make $500 a year. Can you imagine lawyers and congressmen in Washington negotiating who make $500 an hour, negotiating with people who make $500 a year? We've got to fix that disparity by reducing the burden that those families pay to banks in the United States and banks in Europe so that we don't end up taking all of their gold, all of their diamond, and all of their natural resources and bringing them to the first world while leaving them trapped in poverty.
Finally,
the long and the short of it.
Finally, Congressman Jackson, we couldn't leave you without asking you a quick question about police brutality. Is the Congressional Black Caucus, overall Congress, going to take on that issue with a renewed cry for looking at it systemically because of the shooting of Ahmed Diallo in New York, the 22-year-old Ghanaian immigrant who was shot in a hail of 41 police bullets?
We have sought a series of meetings under Congressman Greg Meeks' leadership with the Attorney General of the United States to force the federal government, the Justice Department, to look into all of these acts because it appears to be a culture of permissiveness that is sweeping across the country.
Jesse Jackson, Jr., we want to thank you very much for being with us, the congressman from Illinois.
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we take on the issue of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay with us.
Pirates, yes, thereof I sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my head was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help us sing these songs of freedom?
Freedom
is all I ever had.
All I ever had.
Redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Every month, Democracy Now! Airs All Things Censored, commentaries written by journalist and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, produced by the Prison Radio Project. Recordings of Mumia's voice have been banned by the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, and so each month we bring to you notable people reading his new essays. Jimmy Simmons is a Tatutni Muckleshoot Native American. He spent 13 years in prison in Washington State. He was tried for capital murder of a prison guard and, in an amazing landmark victory, was acquitted. Leonard Wineglass, Abu-Jamal's lead defense counsel, was his attorney. Today, Jimmy Simmons, an operating engineer, lives in Northern California with his wife, Karen Rudloff, and their two young sons.
My name is Jimmy Simmons. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant voice has been silenced and censored. This essay was handwritten in a solitary confinement cell by a man awaiting execution. Prison officials have banned Mumia's voice, so I will read to you one of his illuminating commentaries. Already out of the game. The newest political fever sweeping the nation, the three strikes your outrage, has become law in the United States, thereby opening the door to a state-by-state march to an unprecedented prison-building boom. What most politicians know, however, is what most people do not, that three strikes you're out will do next to nothing to eradicate crime, and it will not create the elusive dream of public safety. They also know that it will be years before the bills come due, but when they do, there'll be real doozies. By then, they reason, they'll be out of office, and it'll be another politician's problem. That's because the actual impact of three strikes will not be felt for at least 10 to 20 years from now, simply because that's the range someone arrested today will face already under the current laws, and the additional time, not to mention additional cost, will kick in by then. It seems a tad superfluous to say that already some 34 states have repeat offenders so-called career criminal laws, which call for additional penalties on the second, not the third, felony in addition to the actual crime. As with every law, taxpayers will have to pay the cost to be boss. Pennsylvanians are paying over $600 million for their prisons. Californians over $2.7 billion, topping costs of higher education. As prisons become increasingly geriatric, with populations hitting their 50s and 60s, these already atmospheric costs will balloon exceptionally, so that although many Americans, an estimated 37 million, don't have guaranteed health care, prisoners will, although of doubtful quality. Frankly, it's always amazing to see politicians sell their "we gotta get tough on crime" shtick to a country that is already the world's leading incarcerator, and perhaps more amazing to see the country buying it. One state has already trod the tough ground back in the 1970s. California led the nation in 1977 with the tough, determinate sentencing law, and their prisons population exploded over 500%. Now boasting the largest prison system in the Western world, 50% larger than the entire federal prison system. Do Californians rushing to pass the three strikes your outlaw feel safer? A more cynical soul, viewing this prison system boom bill through the lens of the economic interests, might suppose that elements of the correctional industry, builders, guards union, and the likes are fueling the boom, at least in part. Another element is the economy itself, where America enters the post-industrial age, when Japan produces the world's computer chips. Germany produces high-performance autos. In America, prisons. Prisons are where America's job programs, housing programs, and social control programs merge into a dark hole, and where those already outside of the game can be exploited and utilized to keep the game going.
Commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, read by Native American activist Jimmy Simmons. Democracy Now! Brings Prison Radio series All Things Censored essays written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and read by notable people to you every month. We'll continue to do so until Abu-Jamal's voice is not censored by prison authorities. And today we bring you the latest news on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. This week, there were dozens of news conferences held around the country to mobilize for a Mumia Abu-Jamal demonstration in Pennsylvania on April 24th. Jose Santiago, the news director at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, attended the news conference in New York. He files this report.
Mumia Abu-Jamal will be a victim of government-sanctioned murder. Government-sanctioned murder, unless we the people stop the execution.
Ron Daniels, head of the Center for Constitutional Rights and host of a press conference in New York today, one of some two dozen simultaneous press conferences held across the United States, Canada, and France. The subject, the Millions for Mumia mobilization, which will include a mass protest demonstration in Philadelphia on Saturday, April 24, and this Friday evening's event at Town Hall in New York City. But while the focus was the quest for a new trial or for the release of Abu-Jamal, it was difficult for speakers at the news conference today to ignore the current uproar in New York over the police killing of Amadou Diallo. Again, Ron Daniels.
It is curious that and tragic that Ahmed Amadou Diallo was the victim of police murder here in the city of New York and in America. This has become an international case. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a victim of police and judicial misconduct. Diallo was seen as, on the basis of racial profiling, was seen as someone who was suspicious and dangerous, a threat to the system. Mumia Abu-Jamal was a victim of political profiling. He was seen as a threat because of his political beliefs, his political ideas, and his staunch advocacy on the part of civil rights and human rights on behalf of black and poor people, oppressed people in this country and around the world.
Added into the mix, reports that the PBA, the union that represents New York City police officers, may be planning a counter-rally outside Town Hall on Friday night. There were conflicting reports today as to whether such a rally is sanctioned by union officials. But organizers of the Millions for Mumia mobilization say they were called by the NYPD yesterday and alerted that there will be a counter-demonstration. Monica Moorhead is a national organizer for the Millions for Mumia mobilization.
I want to make our position crystal clear. We are not going to be intimidated by the PBA or any other police agency. We are going to carry out a strong program to demand no execution and a new trial for Mumia. Furthermore, the police must not infringe on the rights of the people who attend by shutting off the streets or trying to block people from entering Town Hall. Why did we decide to call for a rally at Town Hall? To show the world, and especially the government, that there is broad support across racial, ethnic, religious, political, and class lines from people who believe Mumia Abu-Jamal should have a new trial and that no death warrant should be signed. It is an outrage that the PBA would plan this counter-demonstration at a time when the entire city is enraged over the brutal police slaying of Amadou Diallo. There are very significant connections between these cases. Mumia Abu-Jamal was targeted by the police and framed up because he was an effective opponent of police brutality in Philadelphia. We consider the PBA counter-demonstration to be a pro-police brutality demonstration.
And if there is a police rally at Town Hall this Friday evening, organizers expect that, as in the past, news accounts of the event will focus on the police side of the issue and, as in the past, ignore the arguments raised by Mumia's supporters. Stephen Rendell is with FAIR, which stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He delivered a message to corporate media.
Bias, inaccuracy, and arrogance, as documented by FAIR and others, have plagued news reporting on the legal case against Mumia Abu-Jamal. With few exceptions, corporate-owned media have ignored or misrepresented charges made by Mumia's advocates, charges that witnesses were coerced, that testimony was fabricated or tampered with, that ballistics testing was incomplete or inconclusive, that the judge was prejudiced and mishandled the case, and that Abu-Jamal was denied the right to defend himself as guaranteed by the Constitution and otherwise prevented from mounting a serious defense. In this matter of life and death, the failure to investigate these charges, any one of which, if true, would be grounds for a new trial, is tantamount to openly siding with the prosecution. It is the journalistic equivalent of reversing the burden of proof. FAIR is adding its voice to those who are calling for a fresh look at Mumia Abu-Jamal's situation. We are calling on local and national media to take seriously the charges that a condemned man has not received a fair trial.
As for the status of Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, attorney Leonard Weinglass said today that in the third week of April, the legal team will petition the U.S. Supreme Court for a new trial. He expects that petition to be rejected, at which time the team will file for a federal writ of habeas corpus in the Federal District Court in Philadelphia. If there is no success there, they will appeal to the Federal Appeals Court in the Philadelphia region. And if there is no success there, there will be a second appeal to the United States Supreme Court. In the past, the process would have taken several years, but since President Clinton signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act into law, the process is faster and federal judges are more limited than ever in their ability to overturn state court decisions. In this exchange, attorney Weinglass talked about Mumia Abu-Jamal's reaction when his state appeal was rejected last October, and he discussed the influence that police organizations have in the state of Pennsylvania.
The action of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was a stunning setback, and Mumia is very concerned now as we head into federal court as to whether or not these federal courts will perform their traditional role of intervening when a state system, an elected state system, produces an unjust result.
Mr. Weinglass, do you have any kind of reading on how liberal or conservative this particular court is in Philadelphia, federal judges, what their track record is?
Well, the court is made up of a number of federal judges, I believe 28 total. There are some judges that are quite good on that court and have a very good record, and there are some that are not. I don't know where the percentages are. Unfortunately, the prosecutor who prosecuted Mumia, Ed Rendell, is now the mayor of Philadelphia and a very close friend of the Clinton administration. And his wife has been named by President Clinton as a federal judge who now sits on that court of appeals, which oversees the federal district court. So I don't know where the case is going to be assigned or who ultimately will have control, but I will say this. The federal judge who gets the case will pretty much determine whether Mumia lives or dies.
What kind of influence could the police organizations have in the selection of the judge?
It's very hard for me as an outsider outside of Philadelphia to know that, but I will say this. If you read the trial record, any lawyer reading that trial record will be shocked by the fact that when Mumia's case first came to court in Philadelphia and a judge looking at the case decided that Mumia should be eligible for bail, that judge received in chambers a telegram from the Fraternal Order of the Police telling that judge that he ought to reverse his position. And indeed he did. And that's the nature of things in Philadelphia. It's unfortunately the situation.
But while Mumia's supporters recognize the severity of the legal challenges ahead, today they emphasize the extraordinary amount of organizing that's going on right now. There was a report from Northern California where a youth worker talked about the growing number of young people tuning into Abu Jamal's case. And at the news conference today, actor-activist Ozzie Davis encouraged people to turn out for Friday's gathering at Town Hall. And he urged them to inform themselves on the issue. Ultimately, he said, the people will make a difference.
In my long history as a black man in this country, I've seen many instances where the people and the pressure of the people provided the last resource for the defendants. And sometimes when that pressure, when the people are themselves sufficiently concerned and aroused, they have had the deciding impact on what finally happened to the defendants, the Scottsboro boys, for example, and when Angela Davis and some other cases, Ben Chavis, when the people felt that even the court system itself needed correction from the pressure of the people. I begin to sense that Mumia's case is attracting the attention of the American people, and our hope is to facilitate this, to make this a matter of concern at every breakfast table in the country, so that the people will finally speak, and when they speak, the courts will have to be responsive. I'm a part of the movement that is growing. It's really a people's movement that we begin to sense. And all that we do from here on in will be to encourage the people themselves to get involved in the case, because we know that ultimately that can and will be decisive.
Actor and activist Ozzie Davis speaking about Mumia Abu-Jamal. The report by Jose Santiago. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York.